Hello, I'm Zoe Clark and welcome to Without Borders. Today we're speaking to the fantastic Imogen Osborne, who has held a number of different positions in PR and communications, both agency side and in-house, but now has just recently set up her own organisation called The Pulse Business.
Hi, and I'm Brendan Craigie, and on this episode, Imogen's going to talk to us about why everyone needs research and insights to build a better business, why truth and honesty should be at the heart of every business culture, and finally, how death, divorce, and even some of the most challenging events in our lives can actually make us better and stronger people.
What time did our day start? My day started fairly early.
You had a lion, didn't you? Because we didn't meet till 11:30. You're like, take it easy.
Absolutely. Can you imagine, Brendan? Yeah, I was in bed till about 10:30.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. No.
We're off.
I know. Yeah. No, I got up. I'm also an early bird. I like to swim occasionally, but I also go to the gym very early and do more strength training and crazy boot camp stuff and lift heavy weights and yeah. So
I lift crisps.
My training does help with the gin and tonic glass.
Have we started now?
Okay.
We should ask some serious questions then, yes, I guess. Definitely. Yes. So I suppose certain parallels here between what you're doing, Imogen, and setting up your own business, and Brendan and Taito, of course. So tell us a bit about the Pulse business and how's it going and how are you finding this new chapter?
Gosh, that's an interesting question. I think, you know, running your own business, the one person you're accountable to is yourself. You have meetings with yourself. You give yourself your own performance appraisals. You are your own truth. And I think for anyone running a business of any size, you have to have great discipline. And I've certainly learned with the Pulse business, I love the freedom. I love the fact that I can make a mistake and learn from it, actually, and not be made to feel bad about it, but just go, oh, okay, next time I might do that a little bit differently.
Interesting.
And in terms of this entity, it's now in its fourth month. Each month has been very different. It's a business that is very much dedicated to creating conversations, new conversations. It has a piece of software, which is called Pulse Software, which effectively acts as a listening device. So our clients will use it to find out how happy or not their staff are, or how happy or not their salespeople are with the way marketing organised a sales meeting, or how happy or not their members are, or what their members think of Brexit. Or they'll use the software to get groups of people together and get them communicating, if you like, or giving their feedback on a particular topic, and then building a community of interest around that topic. And it's completely online, and it's a virtual business, which I love, which means that you can sort of cherry pick who you want to work with. So I've very carefully selected a great designer. I have an interesting journey with the IT supplier. Interesting. I could talk forever about software development. It's a very long-term relationship, but it's an interesting relationship. And then obviously the finance and then the marketing and all of that is outsourced. So there are loads and loads of pros for a virtual business. But of course, ultimately, it comes down to you. And you really have to know how to motivate yourself some days. And then other days, it's so busy you don't even have time to think.
Yeah, absolutely. And why this particular business? What's been the driver to, you know, why this importance on measuring and measurement and insights, etc.?
Well, I think the best conversations are had when they're based on real-time insight. And that may be a conversation you have with your client or a conversation you have with a colleague or an industry peer or someone you've met for the first time. Because the conversation can immediately take a deeper direction. You don't have to worry about all the sort of the flim-flam and the frippery and the sort of, you know, making polite conversation just because you have to. You can get right down deep and dirty into the heart of the issue. And I've always, I think, been really slightly obsessed about the truth and telling the truth. So goodness knows why I ended up in PR to begin with, because, of course, you know, one is simply trained to be economical with the truth. But that's me being a little bit cynical. I find if I have a really open conversation with someone, I feel so much better inside. But it's actually quite hard to get people to do that, even now, even in this very transparent age that we live in. It's not instinctive. If you ask someone how happy they are with something, you know, do they actually tell you honestly how they feel? And if they don't tell you honestly how they feel, how do you get them to that place? So sometimes having a little piece of software that's sort of getting a balance on that feeling.
Yeah.
Is a really, really good way to start that conversation and learn new things.
And do you think like the industry has caught up and is ready for this? Do you think things have changed over time, which maybe people are more willing to have these conversations?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think some industries, some organisations, yes. So membership organisations, for example, are actually incredibly comfortable about dealing with the truth. You know, you and I might run a service business and be sort of really affronted if a client complains, because you think, do you know how hard it was to do that? You know, no appreciation of our craft, our trade. And yet, for a membership organisation, they're so used to dealing with flack and so used to managing disgruntled members as, you know, about my pudding at the conference. I was really, you know, just not happy with the chocolate version. Where's vanilla? Or whatever little grumble it is, that it's sort of water off a duck's back. And as a consequence, they listen to the feedback with really, really broad shoulders. So even in some ways, as organisations, they're not that technically advanced. I think they're actually very advanced in terms of how they manage their relationships.
One of the things I think is quite interesting is just thinking about with the whole insights and listening to people. I think we encounter lots of clients that, certainly in a B2B environment, just don't speak to their customers, like ever. Like, unless they're selling to them, they don't actually ask them what they're thinking, what the pressures are, and so on. I think that's been a big eye-opener for us in terms of how valuable that is to actually talk to customers or engage with them. That's one thing. And I think that sort of then flows onto another point, which is that I think often people use research to measure the impact of something, which is kind of helpful, but I think it's especially helpful actually to make sure that you're clear on like your starting off point, you know, like rather, as opposed to measuring the out, you know, the end result of what you've done. I think often you can go so wildly wrong at the starting point by like pointing yourself in a direction which is entirely wrong because you've not properly taken stock of in the first place. And I think that's where I think we're quite interested is we do a lot of the work that we do, we try to ground it in the understanding of the audience we're trying to hit and so on. What's your perspective on in terms of like where's the balance in terms of like the before and after, or you know?
It depends how you're using the insight. Yeah. And I think you're absolutely right. It's very easy to get just stuck into a pattern of researching or evaluating or tracking a topic, an idea, you know, a perception. And then you get to a certain end point. You think, okay, there's the answer. We now know what X percent of people think about that. But the interesting piece is what you actually do with that insight, how you actually act on that data, because I think that's where the greatest way of listening, actively listening, happens. And that's how you build trust with your audiences, because you've asked them a question and they've shared their truth, or we hope most of their truth. And then you're saying, well, thank you very much for sharing that truth. And this is what we're going to do with it. This is not just a piece of research for research's sake, just to generate a headline or to simply prove that people are a bit more positive about, you know, a drink or a piece of technology or whatever it may be. This is about taking that insight and turning it into something much, much deeper that allows you to connect back with the people who could be bothered to tell you.
And so you obviously, you work with lots of different organisations who obviously are very enlightened because they use your services to listen to people. In your experience, you know, where do, in that process, you know, how good are people at following up on what they find out?
Well, I'll sound like a headmistress now. Not as good as they should be.
Yeah.
But those who do reap the rewards. You know, it's a drum that I constantly... And actually, it's part of the sales pitch, if you like. The less time they spend on managing the data and extracting the data, the more time they can spend on acting on the data. And a key discipline is to make sure that whatever we get back, we then present that to the client in a visually pleasing format, in a very nice infographic that makes it very easy to share. So at least they can do that initial action of actually sharing the results. Some people, maybe it's the human condition, I don't know, they're just very transactional, and once the insight is in, they just want to move on to the next best thing. And actually, it's part of our challenge to work with them to say, we haven't finished yet.
Yeah.
We've still got all of this to do. Benchmarking can be a very good way of focusing the mind. But, you know, some organisations are better than others, and the ones that do reap the dividends because they get the best response rates, because they just go up and up and up.
I mean, I guess it's slightly adjacent to what you're... I know you're using research for a whole myriad of different purposes, but within the PR and comms world, there's, you know, like been a big drum beaten about measurement for years. I kind of find it quite dull, you know, and boring.
Yeah.
And I think the reason I find it boring and dull is that it's like... It seems to be obsessed by the process of measurement as opposed to... the why and what you're going to get out of it, and what, you know, that, like, it's like it seems to be very obsessed by the tactic of measurement as opposed to the purpose of it and why you're doing it.
And yes. Sorry, go on,
I was going to say, I think it actually, you should throw away the word measurement and just talk about impact and influence.
Yes. Yeah.
Because that's so much more relevant.
Yeah.
I think part of the challenge is we're still waiting for certain tools to come into the market that, say, particularly in the digital space, can do a really, really good job of analysing, understanding the impact of what happens online and the impact of, you know, working with influencers and what defines an influencer today. I mean, it, you know, never ceases to amaze me that a plumber, you know, putting YouTube videos up of him reviewing Xbox is much more valuable than some chap writing, or some woman, let's be right on, writing in a magazine. You know, people are more likely to look at that YouTube video. But does he know or she know how influential they are? I think we need more tools in place, but and that's something that, you know, you have to look to companies who are slightly, in some areas, ahead of the curve there for what they're going to introduce. But it's not sorted yet.
Yeah.
I think is the upshot.
Was there a specific moment in your career that got you interested in this area of measurement and things?
I think when on the agency side, the initial idea was to build a piece of software that allowed PR and communications agencies to do a better job of measuring and managing client satisfaction, but in real time. Because one of my biggest frustrations when I was running a tech practice for a large agency was that I never knew when the bad news was coming, because I had a team of about 30 people who would sit on bad news like it was a newspaper and just not tell me. And then I would go into a client meeting and see this client sort of wearing almost a funereal mask, and I think, uh-oh, what haven't I been told? So I really wanted, going back to that truth point, to have a tool that would, or a piece of software that could help me uncover the truth, so I could at least prepare for it and maybe fix it and maybe keep the client. But funnily enough, it's amazing when it comes to software, if you keep it open and flexible, it can apply itself to all sorts of different insight needs. And that's essentially what it has done. It's just, I've let the clients help me grow it by telling me what they want to do with it.
So do you think, because so picking up on that point about your experience in agencies, do you think there's like a lack of honesty between, like, within agencies and then between clients and agencies about what's going on, and why is that?
I think that, yes, that still exists. Not across every account. And I think there's a whole slew of factors that determine that. So much of it comes down to the pivotal relationship that the client has with the agency. And, it, you know, a lot of clients, certainly from my experience, always wanted to put all their eggs in one basket and just be talking to the director, which is why when you run client satisfaction pulses, there's, and you ask about how good the team is, there's always some moaning about not being able to see the senior person on the account. Clients like that. They're spending a lot of money. And I think also it's human nature to just not want to necessarily share bad news, because if you're an account director or an account manager and you're hoping for a promotion in the months to come, you're not really going to want to tell your boss's boss that things aren't going so well with Orange this week or whoever your client is. So, yes, unfortunately, I think we have to find a way, or fortunately, we have to find a way of sort of how that core relationship gets shared between client and senior lead, senior agency lead, and also how you encourage the broader team to put their hands up earlier and realise that they can actually call it and say, you know what, this is a mess, or this isn't going to work, or I've made a huge mistake here. And a lot of agencies, I would say, are still working on creating that kind of culture where mistakes are seen as a good thing. People have problems with failure. They don't have any problems with success, but they have a lot of problems with failure.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting. I've found in my career sometimes that some of the hardest pieces of work have actually been the most useful in terms of building that client relationship. Mm. Even a crisis, in some cases, can be really kind of formative, and you can form a really good bond and sort of come out stronger at the end. But yeah,
yes,
I suppose it can come from anything.
I mean, I remember one apocryphal story when I was in my first agency job, and I was the junior person, and was, I think, probably allowed to stand by the photocopier for several hours at a time. And that was about all I was allowed to do. But on one occasion, they let me write a press release, and in the press release, I forgot to put the trademark symbol against this ERP product, and it was a stupid mistake to make, and the client picked it up and you know, complained, you know, you've got to get it right when you put our branding down on paper, which is fair enough, and I learned from that mistake. And then a few weeks later, I was writing a media Q&A for the same client, and I forgot to do it again. And I realised I'd done it before it had gone to the client. And I went to tell the consultant straight away and to just fess up, oh my goodness, I've done it again. And I told him, she said, don't worry, I'll take care of it. It's all right. Thank you so much for letting me know. And I thought, phew, thank goodness, you know, not in trouble this time. And then about 2 days later, I've been out of the office sitting at a Chartered Institute marketing exam, and I came back for team drinks. And the managing director of the agency sort of singled me out, and I thought, oh, maybe he's going to say, well done for being really honest about that trademark blunder. And he said, you're not going to believe the conversation I had with Ross Systems today. And I thought, no, I guess I'm not. And he said, unbelievable that another piece of collateral went across without the trademark in it. And I looked at him and I said, but what do you mean? He said, oh, Angela sent across the Q&A that you did and the trademark hadn't been put in against Promex. I can still remember it so well. And my jaw just dropped because I thought, but I told her. But she'd obviously forgotten to change it. It had gone across to the client. And even worse than the client, well, just as worse as the client seeing it and pulling his hair out, she hadn't put her hand up.
That's
and I
terrible.
Just thought, oh. How could you do that?
That's awful.
And that, it, you know, so hence a slight obsession for the truth travels with me in PR. Because
yeah. I think as you go through your career, you realise that certainly in the eyes of 99% of people, the more honest you are about problems and issues, the more you get people's respect, the more you get people's trust. I mean, I used to, like, as I was coming through the ranks in my previous agency, I used to like really spend a long time before I met with my manager, who was the founder of the agency, to think, what bad stuff do I need to tell them? Like, you know, I wouldn't want them to come out of the meeting thinking the world is going to end, but I would definitely want them to know about any potential risks. Mm. because it made me feel good. It made me feel good, actually, being transparent. And I think, actually, it then builds trust with someone. You know, but it's about having judgment, isn't it? Like, you don't want to, like, say, there are 100 possible things that could go wrong in the next week.
I need to offload them all. Yeah, yeah. My boss.
But, you know, if there are one or two things you're a little bit worried about, I think it's good to share those because it shows that you're in control.
And what's the worst that can happen?
Yeah.
You know, I'm a great believer, probably after childbirth, of thinking, what is the worst that can happen to me now? Because, you know, that is just so mind-blowing in itself. Mm-hmm. And I just don't worry about telling the truth because, as you say, your conscience is clear.
Question for both of you then, I guess. I mean, do you think that, you know, being a parent does change things in that dramatic way, or are there other things as well that make you put things into perspective in life?
I think one thing is that I definitely have, like, an incredible capacity to do things in life, you know, like, as in, you know, like, at the weekend, I took my kids to watch Liverpool play at Wembley, you know, so I took them from London to the UK. And then, you know, flew back on Sunday, then went swimming, then, you know, early evening, then I made pizza, like, from scratch, I should say.
Ooh. And then posted some pictures on Instagram.
And, you know, and so, you know, like, and I had some friends who were like, my God, you're unbelievable. I can't believe you did all that, you know? But I do think as a parent, you learn to... you find time that you just didn't know that you existed. And I think probably looking back at my younger self, I think you can waste so much time. So actually, I think that's one thing I think from being a parent is just making the absolute most of the time that you've got.
And you're very driven to do that as well if you work because your time is so precious. And I think, you know, one of the things that drove me to set up my own business was because I really wanted to have, I wanted to be able to do both jobs brilliantly. I wanted to be a great mum and I wanted to be really good at what I was doing professionally. And time, if managed well, and if you, you know, if you take time to do each job properly, you don't have to do it again. So having a conversation with either one of my boys is not a 30-second conversation. It's, right, let's have a conversation. You can imagine they love it because, of course, it takes about 10 minutes when we have to get to the middle of the conversation and then the end of the conversation. But at least then I know I've dissected whatever it is we're talking about and we have decided on the plan of action. And it might be a homework thing, it might be a social thing or whatever. And then likewise applying that in work. I hate rushing things because I know I won't do such a good job. And as Brendan says, you have to sort of have you kind of uncover an unknown energy. Even when you're brutally tired, you still somehow manage to kind of keep it all going. When people are, you know, spending Sundays reading the paper from cover to cover, you know, Sunday Times going, oh, lovely, 3 hours. And, you know, you've rewired the national grid in Wembley and then... you know, gone swimming and made homemade pizza. Yeah. You know, that's brilliant. It's very rewarding.
But is there an art to finding, to kind of carving out that time in a day then? I mean, it sounds like it just sort of comes naturally maybe, but I'm sure there's more to it than that, whether it's, you know, it's something you're particularly passionate about, you know?
You just have to be very disciplined and you have to want to do it.
Exactly. I think that's it ultimately, isn't it? I think you need to, I mean, you need to trade off what you want to do versus what your kids want to do and sort of find that balance.
And while we're on the topic of children, I guess, I believe you're a particular advocate of childhood reading. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So both my children, whether they liked it or not, were read to religiously from very early ages because my philosophy is that you're never alone if you have a book under your arm. You can go anywhere in the world, by yourself, with friends. You've always got a companion. And there's so much information out there and such a short lifespan to get it all into your brain. And it's even now, you know, particularly with the rise of mobile devices and how, you know, we ran a pulse recently around our mobile phones killing the art of conversation. And interestingly, half the people said, yes, they are, and it's a terrible thing, and we should just, you know, all leave the world immediately and go back to the dark ages. But then a large proportion of people were saying, well, actually, no, they just evolve the conversation because you can, you know, you can WhatsApp with someone, you can text, you know, you can pick up your emails, you can also watch videos, you can share what's happening in your life. There are lots and lots of positives there. And I think, you know, for both my boys, Theo, my oldest, is... I mean, he's like a walking library. He just loves his books. And I feel as a parent, I've done a good job. The younger one actually is not so keen on reading. So we do a lot of reading together, but we do quite a bit of online reading as well to get him comfortable. But I think it's the best thing you can give them.
Yeah.
Because it all sorts of things open up.
So do you think in the workplace then that does technology, for example, enhance and help us have those kind of conversations? I suppose in your world, in your position, it must do a bit, but is it also in some ways an inhibitor and you know, something we can hide behind?
I don't think it is an inhibitor. I think used in the right way, you can get brilliant results. But it's like anything, you know, there's a lot of coverage at the moment on that game Fortnite. Everyone's talking about, I think, I saw an article yesterday saying that Fortnite was responsible for 5% of divorces. Yeah. You know, never mind what's going on in terms of what's happening with the children who are playing it, who are underage. And I think you have to be very careful with the tool that you're using, particularly when it goes into the hands of young minds. They need to be stimulated to talk, they need to be stimulated to read, they need to be stimulated to go out and play football or play tennis or swim or whatever it is, to you know, take the best of what life has to offer and to manage it responsibly. But the only people who can help them do that are teachers and parents. So certainly in the early stages.
Definitely. What advice will you be giving your kids as they go into the world of work then, and steering them in there?
Always be on time. That's particularly for the older one. It just has a 36-hour clock. Always be on time. And be true to your word. You know, if you say you're going to do something, do it. Prove that you can be relied upon, because I think people find that quality so attractive. It's a brilliant reason to hire someone. It's a brilliant reason to promote someone. So be on time and be reliable. Bit dull, but...
I think being on time is important, isn't it?
Brendan's a big fan of being on time.
Yeah, I think it's about showing respect to someone, isn't it? Thinking about, I guess, you know, you've had loads of, you know, different careers, in-house, agency, you know, now in a different field of research, had lots of highs. Have there been any, like, really tough times during that period that have, like, really, and, like, how have they shaped you?
Gosh, yeah, there have been quite a few. I think one of the toughest professional times I went through was when, so for the first sort of 10 years of my career, I'd just sort of gone up and up and up, got promoted, you know, didn't have any children, so could work was my life, my baby. And I got to, I was working for Cisco and I was running comms across Europe, and I had to deal with a lot of the senior leadership team, including, well, he's now the ex-CEO, but John Chambers, who was there for about 30 years. It was a bit like dealing with the CEO for IBM, you know, or Bill Gates. He was massive, massive. Quite a nice guy. And so I'd kind of had the world at my feet. And then I married the wrong person, and realised that pretty quickly. And then as I was realising that, I found out I was pregnant with our son, which sort of catalysed me deciding that I had to exit the marriage, for the simple reason that he's a chronic alcoholic. So, I think I was spending so much time thinking about my work, I wasn't thinking enough about my relationship, and I was assuming that all this mad party drinking was just going to sort of dissipate once we got married and settled down and started talking about wallpaper. And actually it didn't. It just got worse and worse. And I then left Cisco to take on an even bigger job because financially my ex-husband had just, I think he had six-figure debts by that stage. And I knew I was going to have to be the breadwinner. And I have to say those sort of 4 years were black years. And the only thing really that kept me going was Theo, because I just thought that's a purpose. There he is, that little light on the black, black canvas. But I remember going into the agency and, oh my goodness, it was such a brutal agency. You know, you lived and died by your P&L. If you weren't, you know, 21% profitable, they were so down on you. And I actually joined that agency just as the dot-com bubble burst. So a £2 million business, which was just the tech practice alone, went down to £200,000, which meant that I had to lay off all these people that I didn't know, desperately try and win business from a bunch of other people I didn't know and had all of whom had threepence halfpenny to spend, and somehow hope I was going to keep this job as well as getting about 4 hours sleep a night and living in a house by myself and really thinking, is this what I want out of my life? But I always used to say to myself during that time period, all the pain you're feeling now will help you later on, and you could help somebody else with it.
Yeah.
Because you'll have empathy.
Yeah.
And even though you didn't choose this path, in the sense that, you know, when you were 15 years old, you didn't imagine this would be the part of your life story. You have to repurpose it. You have to reframe it. We had a really, really good, one of the few really good things about the agency, a really, really good management consultant who came in and worked with all the directors. And he was very good at getting you to share your life story. And he got chapter and verse and then it all over again when we sat down. But he talked to me about reframing things, that you can go into a situation and just think everything is awful and I just don't know how I'm going to cope and I'm on my knees here. I'm so tired, I can barely speak. And he would say, yes, you're all of those things, but what is the greater purpose? Reframe it. Think about your end goal. And it was having those little inspirational touches that helped me. And I think also I look back on that time and, oh my goodness, does it make me appreciate what I have now?
Yeah.
I've had to work very hard for it, but I certainly don't take it for granted.
Yeah. I think those are very valuable experiences, aren't they? Mm. One, you know, the thing about appreciating what you've got, which you don't until you've, you know, experienced more challenging times. But then also that thing about having empathy with people. I think probably as a younger person, I think I've always been quite nice. but I think until you've had challenging times yourself, it's very hard to empathize with people and realize that, unless you're exceptionally lucky at some point in your career or your life, you're going to have a very difficult time, whether it's like bereavements or divorce or whatever it is. And I think, having that sort of compassion to understand people and sympathize with them and stick by them is a really nice quality.
Mm. Well, it's something I've certainly learned to value, as well as having sort of tenacity as well, because I've remarried. My husband's brilliant. He supports me on so many levels. He can also be very challenging personality at times. But I have the tenacity to find ways for us to fix the things that we may not agree on. And this was actually quite a bizarre journey and experience for him, you know, talking about problems and stuff. He's, you know, he's Mr. Optimistic. He is sunshine yellow every day. Nothing's a problem. You know, it's always wonderful, blah, blah, blah. Whereas I'm a bit more of a realist. But actually, we are so much better at talking through things that can be very tricky. Stepchildren, for example, because I have two stepchildren, and that is an unknown journey before you embark upon it. And likewise, he's inherited a stepson. And he's had to sort of get his head round what it's like living with Theo, which I find challenging as much as I love him. I love you. If you hear this, I love you. It's a very difficult thing to do, to be a step parent, because you go into it very objectively. You don't have the sort of the sweet rose-coloured spectacle love for these children, and neither they for you, because, you know, who is this person challenging me, laying rules down, saying I can't do this? And you have to... my best advice to any new step-parent is learn how to cook, because when it gets stressful, take yourself into the kitchen and bake cake.
Right.
Because it is the solution. A, they take a while to make, so you... take yourself
That's
out of whatever's
advice.
Going on. And B, you get to eat cake.
Yes. So. Do you make the cake and then just eat it yourself? Or is part of this that you're actually
alone.
Making cake to sort of build bridges with,
That's it. Yeah. But I allow myself generally the choice of cake.
Yeah.
I do that. And I found that actually putting a meal on the table or bringing us together with food was a very powerful thing, because for all their angst, for all their reasons to possibly dislike me as a step-parent, not that there was that particularly, but there were certainly things we disagreed with or have disagreed with over the years. If we were sitting down and breaking bread together, it kind of neutralised it because we were saying we can find a way to get on with each other. And I think also my husband, when he was growing up, there wasn't a lot of family mealtime. It just seemed to happen on a Sunday. And then he was whisked back off to boarding school. And you hear a lot of parents today lamenting about the fact they either don't have time or it seems impossible to get the family together on a regular basis for meals. And, you know, I'm not saying you have to have breakfast, lunch and dinner every day, but at the weekend or when Louis and Oscar come over, there's always a big meal as part of the whole experience. And I find that is a really good thing. And it's really good for me mentally because I can just go, I want to switch off.
And thinking about sort of like your marriage partnership, how important is that, do you think, in life in terms of your success? Like, is it integral to it, or is it like just do you see it as just being a completely different part of your life, or is it woven up with the success you have in work?
Gosh, that's a really good question. I would actually say that before I married, when I was single, that was when I was at my most successful professionally, because it was all I had to think about. And now I would say it is integral to it, but you know, if I have to choose between the two, that my marriage wins each time. So it's that's a very clear cut thing. It's a wonderful thing because it bolsters you. You know, when things aren't going great at work, there is nothing better than sharing it with a partner or a boyfriend or a girlfriend, etc. Because you can just get rid of the stress and get another perspective. And I really missed that when I was a single parent because who could I talk to? The wall, you know. Theo was 13 months old. It wasn't a lot he could really say back. But yes, I would say that it's integral, but it demands an awful lot of attention.
Yeah. One of the things I've been thinking as you've been talking about all these different elements of sort of family life and difficult times and things getting more challenging maybe in as you go through life, and also bringing us back to the point you were making about the importance of conversation in the workplace and also honesty in the workplace. It's interesting to think about how in this kind of age where we're all, especially like for us, for example, at Taito, in this kind of distributed working environment where everyone's a little bit more further apart and we're all so busy, honesty not only just about doing the right thing and being a good employee in that sense, but actually being honest and having conversations about what's going on in your life with your colleagues. And making sure that, where's the line? You've got to kind of find
it's culture, right? Balance, again, I think. Yeah. And I think the best cultures are the ones that encourage the individual to be the whole individual at work. You know, a lot of this sort of diversity and inclusion debate that is going on at the moment, it's all driven around creating environments where no matter where you're from, what your ethnicity is, you know, whatever you believe in, if you can walk into a work environment or your work environment, your place of work, and feel at home, that is incredibly important. And I think people give more when they feel that welcome. I mean, I know when I was at Skype, somehow, despite the, you know, there was a mad drinking party culture there. I loved it. I was 10 years too late for it, but I absolutely loved it. But somehow we all managed to come in the next day and we'd always continue putting our heart and soul into our roles and giving our utmost because we just loved being there. And it actually wasn't about the money. It was about the whole culture and what we could do. And the fact that, you know, we were kind of on a ship and we had no destination. We sort of knew, you know, eBay was watching because they'd spent rather a lot of money buying the company. But there was a great sense of adventure. And Cisco, by contrast, it was a different culture. People were very much joined up by what their net worth was. Those were generally the only conversations. People would be tracking the stock price. There was a little ticker you would get on your laptop every day telling you whether it was 73.38 or whatever it was. And people would literally be sitting there trying to work out how many millions they were worth. And while that united people, it was very, very narrow-minded. Yeah. You know, my father died while I was at Cisco, and I remember my boss, I wanted to take quite a significant amount of time off work on compassionate leave, and I remember him calling me, I think it was on about day 7, saying, "So, when are we going to see you back?" And I just thought, really? Really? My father has just died. But I don't, you know, had that been Skype, it would have been, they wouldn't have even phoned.
Yeah.
They would have just said, "Take your time."
Yeah.
And being incredibly respectful about that. So honesty, I think treating people as human beings, as the big friendly giant says, is so important because it builds the trust.
Yeah.
And it's actually quite inspiring and refreshing.
Yeah. No, I think that's great, isn't it? Like the sharing the more raw stuff is what builds teams,
isn't it? In a small organisation, you are a family, really. Mm. You know, interesting.
You spend so much time at work, don't you?
Exactly. I think this is completely different, but I think also if you're on a speedboat as opposed to like a slow oil tanker.
I was imagining a yacht, actually.
That's more exciting as well. You know, like as in, I think if you feel like, metaphorically, if you feel the wind in your hair because your business is going places and you know, it's changing and it's evolving, that's great, I think, in terms of building camaraderie and spirit. Whereas, you know, if it feels like you're sort of living in slow motion and, you know, things going really slowly, then that's less good for gelling people together.
Definitely. You know, people need a purpose.
Yeah.
They need to know what they're doing matters, counts. You know, even if it's simply welcoming people when they walk through the door, to organising the office party, to coming up with a new product idea, the more a company culture can encourage that, you know, the whole sort of from start to finish, the A to Z, everybody's important, everybody has a voice. I think it just gets everybody involved so much more. And you know, who wants to be on that slow boat? Nobody.
No.
No one at all.
Well, no one I know.
So talking of boats, if you had to take a boat to your desert island desk, where would your desert island desk be?
Oh, well, it would have to be somewhere, I don't know, probably South America. And I'd probably be a little bit dangerous and I wouldn't, you know, necessarily go for the Brazil, San Paulo option. I might sort of head for Venezuela. And I would just, I have a vision in my head as you say this. I would really like to have a kitchen with yellow tiles in it. And I could come into my kitchen, which would obviously have very good cooking
Absolutely.
Utensils and baking.
Ready for baking when you needed to escape.
Blah, blah. But also really open plan where I could sit and work and feel life and work together. And it would be very green, brilliant view and lots of chaos somewhere in the distance.
Is that for inspiration? Or?
Yeah, as a reminder that there is a mad, mad world out there. And that at any time, if I was feeling a bit stir crazy and I just wanted to get out, I could just go from the yellow tiled haven and walk into those streets and just completely forget where I was. Love that.
Amazing.
Is that possible to arrange?
I think we can give it a go.
And we'll come around for cake.
Imogen, thanks so much. Thanks for listening to Without Borders. If you like what you've heard, why not subscribe? And if you want to find out more about Taito and what we're up to, you can find us at taitopr.com. That's TYTOPR.com.